Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 16th of July 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. And we are streaming live tonight and I do have my co-host with me, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, how are you doing tonight?
I'm very well, thanks. It's good to be back. The sun's out today, which is nice.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day here in Blighty. And we are going to be talking about Britain today. We were going to be moving on to the Indus civilization, but at the end of last week's episode, we started talking about the importance of the tin trade and the importance of tin to the Bronze Age, because without tin, there would have been no Bronze Age. But in the Fertile Crescent, which is where we've been for the last five episodes of the series, there isn't any tin. So where do they get the tin from? And this is a mystery, basically. And I think it's a mystery that we can answer. They got the tin from Britain. So we're going to be talking about that today and the importance of tin and looking at how that fits in with British history. Were you aware of how important the tin trade was to Britain before we decided to do this subject, Patriarch?
No, not really. To be honest, it's been a subject that I've not really I've not touched on it at all, and I guess it's a subject that not many people have regarded as being quite important, but I guess it really was, wasn't it, in establishing the nations, and a lot of the technologies were built up on it. So I guess it is quite important. So yeah, it'd be quite interesting to understand it on a deeper level.
Well, yeah, it's something you would imagine that they would be teaching all the British school children about. I mean, Britain was really, really important to the ancient world. I mean, as I was looking into this, I discovered that 2/3 of the world's copper used to come from British mines. And it must have been, I don't know, something like 90% of the tin must have come from the British mines in the ancient world. And this is at the time of the flowering of civilization, the beginning of civilization. And it never could have taken place if there hadn't been an abundance of tin. And there wasn't an abundance of tin anywhere apart from in Britain. So this proves that Britain was connected up to the Fertile Crescent. And Britain was vitally important to the Fertile Crescent and the functioning of the civilizations there, because they just couldn't have created bronze without it. And nobody really seems to know about this. I guess the Cornish might know about it. Their national flag is a white cross on a black background. And that is supposed to be that the streams of tin from St. Piran brought over a slab. And apparently the Cornish miners had forgotten how to smelt tin, and he showed them how to smelt it on this granite slab, and the streams of tin that came out from the slab went into a cross shape, and that's the origin of the flag of St. Piran. And it's actually quite a complicated process, really, to actually smelt tin. And you think, well, how did people discover this? They cannot have discovered it by trial and error. They had, you know, it gives credence to this idea that angels taught early man some of the gifts of civilization. That's what it tells us in the Book of Enoch, and it tells us in Genesis that these descendants of Cain, they came out with metallurgy, makeup, musical instruments. Because you think, well, how is somebody going to work out that if you bash all these rocks up and then you heat them at a certain temperature and then you add charcoal to it, then you're going to get a specific type of metal out from it? Because tin can be got in two different ways. You can pan for it in the same way that you can pan for gold, or you can get it out from a substance called cassiterite, which is in granite. And in order to do that, you have to smelt it, and it's not something you're going to discover just by trial and error. It's very, very strange to me. And then this really got me thinking about all the rest of metallurgy. It's something I don't really know that much about, but it really is an important part of our civilization, is knowing how to make all these metals. And where do we get these ideas from? And people don't really understand how important Britain actually was to that. So as I was saying, last week we said we'd be moving on into the Indus Valley civilization, but then before we finished, we started talking about the importance of the Fertile Crescent locating a source of tin before the Bronze Age could actually begin. And my thesis is that it was Britain, and I think we'll be able to convince people of that as we go through this. And most of these quotes that I've got here have come from mainstream websites to do with tin. So if we learn a little bit about tin first, tin was vital to the ancients because it was needed in the making of bronze. Bronze was an alloy or a mixture of two or more metals. To make bronze, the metalsmith mixed copper with the proper amount of tin. Copper tools and weapons by themselves were too soft and did not long remain sharp. Tin made the copper harder and also made the molten metal fill the mould more completely when it was cast into useful objects like axe heads, hammers, and jewellery. So many useful articles were made of bronze in ancient times that no civilization could thrive very long without a supply of it or the copper and the tin needed to make it. And in Cornwall and in Britain, you've got both those substances. You've got copper and you've got tin. And as I was saying, just 200 years ago, Cornwall was providing 2/3 of the world's copper. There's that much copper that was there and that much tin that was there. And as I was saying, the difficulty of actually working out how you can get the tin from the cassiterite, who is going to think of mixing together the copper with the tin to make brass as well? I don't think that could have come about by surprise. And also you can add arsenic to it. But you think about the people that were mining arsenic, how dangerous that was, and the fumes from doing this metallurgy as well. Because if you were to come across it by surprise, you would think, well, I don't want to do that again because it killed that last person that tried it, so we won't try that again. So they had to have known that there was something valuable at the end of it in order to continue with it. So it says to me that they couldn't have discovered this, you know, just by accident.
No, or if they did, then it would have taken, like you say, a lot of lives and also a lot of years and additional experience with other metals. And so you can add maybe 1,000 to 2,000 additional years onto that in experience with the metalwork, if they did kind of discover it by chance. I'm not too sure, but as we move forward, just wanting to understand why we're establishing kind of Britain as the main source. Is it simply because Britain had the minerals in order to mine and the bronze and tin and copper? I mean, were these minerals not evident elsewhere or present elsewhere?
No, there was no tin in the Fertile Crescent. There was a small bit of copper, I think, in Anatolia. They've discovered that there were small tin mines in the Balkans, but hardly used and not that go back this far. But in Britain, and particularly in Cornwall, that there's masses of tin. It's a really rare substance. When you look at how much of it appears in the millionths of the Earth's surface, it's something like two bits to every million bits in the Earth's surface, whereas iron appears like 50,000 bits to every million bits in the Earth's surface. It's quite a rare substance, but there's masses of it in Cornwall. And there wasn't any of it in the Fertile Crescent. And they've sort of had a theory that maybe they got it from Iran, but there really isn't that much there in Iran either. And to have both of them together, copper and tin, in Cornwall, the two substances that you need to make brass, it means that Britain it would have been a great big prize, basically. In fact, later on, that was the reason why Julius Caesar wanted to come into Britain, because he wanted to corner the tin trade. We had these traders called the Veneti that were in Brittany, and they were responsible for taking the tin from the Britons at the time, and they would then sell it on into the continent, and Julius Caesar wanted that. So that was really the reason why he came into Britain, is because he wanted to corner this tin trade, because tin and copper were so important for even in Roman times, because when the Iron Age took over, iron became more important, but bronze was still, you know, of very much importance. You think this whole age was named after this substance, bronze, and the largest source of the two metals that were needed for making this bronze was only really available in Britain. And as we'll see, we have evidence to show that they were doing this in Britain in 2500 BC.
It's interesting. I just I wonder, moving forwards, I know we're saying Britain, but back then, what would they have called it as a geographical location? Do we know? Is it the same or?
Well, according to the oldest records, it was originally called Albion, and there's an interesting myth as to why it was called Albion. Apparently, there was a Phoenician or Syrian king, and he had lots and lots of daughters. And I believe the king's name was Dungi, and this is at the time of that we're talking about, the very early sort of 3000 BC, at the time of the beginning of this Fertile Crescent. There was a king in that area of Phoenicia, and he had, I forget how many daughters, it may have been 40 daughters, something like that, and he married them off to princes. And these daughters were pretty much feminists, and they refused to do what their husbands told them to do. So the husbands told the king, this Dungi, they said, these daughters you've given me, they're faulty. They won't do as they're told. So he said, well, you've got to submit to your husbands. And he said this to his daughters. And the oldest one was called Albion. And she said to her sisters, she said, well, you know what we'll do tonight then? As soon as they're all asleep, we'll slit their throats. And they did. Wow. And they all slit their husband's throats. And because of that, they were put on a ship and sent away out of Phoenicia in this ship. And they went off in this ship, Albion and her sisters, and they eventually washed up on an island with white cliffs, which was, we know today as Britain. And it was named after her. It was named after Albion. And apparently the myth says that there were giants there, and the daughters then slept with the giants and produced strange creatures. And they think that rather than giants, it was talking about the Gigantes, which is an old tribe that were apparently in Britain at the time. And then after that, you get Brutus, the Trojan prince, and he came over and he made war against these peoples and subdued them. But they were basically part of the same. They were white people. They were part of the same, type, the Adamite type. And he then named the island Britain after himself, after Brutus, which is where we get the name Britain from. And British means to look like Brutus. So originally it was called Albion. And Albion also means white, which is for the white cliffs of Dover. Because Alba is the Latin for white, and then you get albumin, which is the white in the egg, and Albion means the white island, basically. And Brutus turned up on the white island, and he was given a vision, and by Diana, the goddess Diana, he made a sacrifice to Diana, and she gave him a vision and said that if he went to this island, he would start an empire that would last for all time. And he conquered Britain, and he started the royal line in Britain that goes all the way up to King Arthur and the rest of them. And obviously, then we had
the current monarch.
Yeah, they're all interconnected, aren't they?
I think I've seen that Brutus, he's somehow connected to the line of Judah, right? Through the line of Pharaohs. But that's obviously, we're deviating a lot on that one.
We are. Well, I'll just say how that could happen, because Judah had two sons, Pharaohs and Zerah, and they were two twins. And Zerah put his hand out first of all, and a red cloth was tied around it. And then his hand went back in, and then Pharaohs came out first. But so really it was Zerah who had the birthright. He was the first one. But what happened was Pharaohs was made into the king. And at the time of Moses, Zerah and his descendants disappear from the narrative in the Bible. They do a census and Zerah's people are no longer there. But Pharaoh's people are. Pharaoh's line started the Davidic kings. And Zerah had two sons, Calcol and Darda. And Calcol and Darda are mentioned as the progenitors of Troy. And they started off Troy and the kingly line in Troy. So from that kingly line in Troy, you then get Aeneas, who was Brutus's father. And Aeneas married the daughter of Latinus, the Italian king, or the Etruscan king Latinus. And it was his line that started off Rome and the Roman Empire. And then Brutus went to Britain and started off the British kings. You've also got the Irish kings that tie into that. So they all go back through Zerah to Judah. So you have a, you have Judah has twin sons. One of the twins stays in Canaan, and he becomes the father of the Davidic kings. And the other son, Zerah, he leaves Canaan and sets up Troy, and then all the civilizations that come after that, the Romans and the Britons. So you basically you had the story of the Israelites continuing outside of that area, that area of Canaan. We are going a little bit off topic here, but maybe some of the listeners hadn't heard that before. They can look it up themselves.
Well, I mean, it's off topic, but I think also with these trade routes that we're kind of establishing was present through tin and all these precious metals, we're kind of connecting them areas, aren't we, together, and just basically showing how they could have potentially been interconnected.
Well, yeah, this is the point. Britain was connected up to the ancient world. Britain wasn't cavemen living in caves, running around half naked and clubbing women over the head. It was mining for tin, and the tin was then being picked up by ships and carried over land and carried back to these city-states in Mesopotamia and Egypt and the Indus Valley. And we were connected up to them. And as we learned in one of these earlier episodes, they had a mail system. They could fill out these clay tablets, and the postman would take the message to elsewhere in the kingdom. And when we read about Solomon, he talks about how he had taxes being paid to him from all over the known world. And the known world included Britain. It's talked about as the Isles of the Sea in the Bible. So these tin routes and this tin trade that we're talking about here, this proves that Britain was connected up with the center of civilization, which was basically in this Fertile Crescent. Why would you start building a civilization in the north where it's cold and it's difficult to live, when you can have one in the Fertile Crescent, which is called the Fertile Crescent because it was really fertile, and it was very easy to produce crops there and to do farming there, but you still needed things that could only be got from outside of that area. So there was also things like amber, which would come from the Baltic states, Lithuania and Latvia, and the copper and the tin, which would come from Britain. Obviously, Britain was called a different name back then, as I was saying. It's called Albion, or it was referred to as the Isles of the Sea in the Bible, that is. So it is all connected up anyway.
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, tin is essential for making bronze, and it comes from roasting cassiterite, which is always found near granite, yet there are little to no granite resources in the Near East. The greatest source of tin in the ancient world was in Britain, and since the Near East had enough tin for it not to be a precious metal, they must have had a large supply of it somewhere, and that supply was likely the tin mines of Devon and Cornwall. Because when you think about it, tin was extremely rare. Because there was no tin in the Fertile Crescent, tin should have been as valuable as gold or silver, but it wasn't. It was still able to fuel the Bronze Age, so they must have had a limitless supply of it somewhere. And the only place there was a limitless supply of it was in Britain. So logic tells you it had to be in Britain, but there's more evidence than that will confirm this. Wikipedia says that Cornish tin was first mined in 2150 BC, but the Bronze Age began around 3000 BC in Mesopotamia. I think that tin was being mined much earlier in Britain than is currently supposed, and that we either have not yet found evidence to prove that, or the evidence has been ignored because people think the Britons were just cavemen at that stage. And we'll see later on in these quotes that they think it was really around about 2500 BC that they can confirm that the Cornish miners were mining this tin. Now, this first quote that I've got here comes from the Pennsylvania Museum. They say, "The two metals which make up bronze have been of interest to scholars for many years. The sources of copper and tin available to ancient metalworkers have been the subjects of much speculation, and it is now more or less agreed that the copper deposits of Cyprus, Turkey, Palestine, and Iran were all important factors in Bronze Age metallurgy. But tin has proved more elusive, because there are almost no geologically verified deposits in Southwest Asia or the Eastern Mediterranean area. Because the origin of the tin used by ancient bronze workers cannot be pinpointed with accuracy, it has become the mystery metal of the ancient Near East." So that's the establishment view on it. They know that there's all this tin that's there in Britain, but because the mainstream narrative says that the Britons were just cavemen back then, it couldn't have been them that were producing it. But it has to be, because that was the only place that actually had an excess of tin, was actually in Britain.
Yeah. I wonder how populated Britain or Albion would have been back then. Do you think there's a chance that it was literally just like some kind of factory-based land, you know, that it was just used not for settlers but more for just, you know, workers and mining, like a one big mining plot of land, and then later they settled, sure, you know, when sort of Romulus came along?
Yeah, that's the way that I would see it. I think they would have sent out prospectors and adventurers that would have gone out on the ships from that, really, that landing strip which is there, which we call Israel today, or Palestine. I mean, it's really just a great place to, the Levant is really just a great place to push ships off from to go out and explore. And I think they would have gone out in ships from there, gone through the Pillars of Hercules, and gone all the way along the coast looking for what they could find. And Cornwall is right on the coast there. So all of this tin and all of this metal wealth, they would have found on the coast. And the earliest historians say that Europe wasn't peopled by people. There were people that were living along the coasts, but that was it. The inlands were not inhabited, basically. So I think you would have had a settlement that had built up around the areas where the metals were, and they would have been working there, and then they would have been sending stuff back to the Fertile Crescent. Maybe they would have been going back along with the merchants at some point. And also the Phoenicians supposedly cornered this. They completely cornered this trade, and they wouldn't let anybody else out through the Pillars of Hercules because they didn't want them to know where their source of tin was coming from. So it was secret as well where they were getting it from. And they would even scupper their ships. If there was a ship that was following them, they would scupper the ship, and they would be reimbursed for that lost ship, because it was so important to the Phoenicians that nobody else knew where this tin was coming from. And we'll find out later on as well that although we refer to them as Phoenicians, again, they were a different people as well. But anybody that actually lived in that area was called the Phoenicians. Much as it is today, anybody that lives in Britain calls themselves British. Back then, 5,000 years ago, it was the same. Anybody that lived in Phoenicia would call themselves Phoenician. Anybody that lived in Mesopotamia would call themselves Mesopotamian, or if they lived in Sumer, they would call themselves Sumerian, regardless actually of their ethnicity. It's like we read in the Bible of Ruth the Moabite. Well, she can't have been a Moabite ethnically, because there were no Moabites living in the land of Moab, and there hadn't been for 150 years. There'd just been Israelites living there. But she's still referred to as Ruth the Moabite. So when we hear about these Phoenicians, it's talking about people that left from that land of Phoenicia, but they weren't actually Phoenicians. But again, because we read in the Bible that that area had all the Canaanites had been removed from that area. We'll actually see later on that it was the tribe of Asher that were mm-hmm. doing this. Well, the earliest reports we have of the tin trade in Britain talk about the Britons mining it and the Phoenicians purchasing it, but the Britons must have learned about it from somewhere. Phoenicia is now known as Syria and Lebanon, and it was the northernmost part of the Fertile Crescent, right next to Assyria, and peopled with whites and Arab-type labourers and slaves, as we have already discussed. So this Phoenicia, which is where the merchants were coming from, where the tin was coming from, it was right next to Assyria. And the earliest references that we have to tin and bronze come in the Sumerian text from Phara, which date to the middle of the 3rd millennium BC, so 2500 BC. An analytical work supports the textual evidence by establishing that tin bronze was being made in Mesopotamia at the same time. The major textual evidence pertinent in a reconstruction of the tin trade comes from the early 2nd millennium in the tablets of Kiltepe and Mari. Merchants from Assyria brought tin in appreciable quantities to central Anatolia, which is now called Turkey, implying that the latter area did not have its own sources of tin, at least in this period. but the texts do not tell us how the tin got to Assyria or where it came from. It has generally been assumed that the tin came from northwestern Iran, although this is not explicitly stated, and there is no geological evidence for tin in that area. And that comes from the Pennsylvania Museum as well. So what we have there is 2500 BC, we have in Assyria, they knew about smelting tin. Then you've got the country next door, which is Phoenicia, which we are told is that was the place that was bringing all the tin in, and they were going to Britain to get it. So this tells us how the people that were in Britain knew about how to smelt the tin, is because they must have come from Assyria through Phoenicia to Britain, because this earliest reference to it is right next to Phoenicia. And it just seems obvious to me, you know, how the British learned about this was like this, because they came from the Phoenicians, and the Phoenicians were right next to the Assyrians, and the Assyrians knew how to do this. And as we've talked about before, it tells us actually in the Bible that it was the sons of Cain were taught how to do metallurgy by the angels, basically. It tells us that in the Book of Enoch as well. So somehow or another, this group in the Fertile Crescent knew how to do metallurgy, but they didn't actually have the metals there that they needed. And then you've got others in that area that then go out to Britain where they find the metals that are needed, and then bring it back. So I think that, you know, this shows this is the only way that it could have happened, basically, but they don't want to admit it.
Is there any chance that the precious metals could have been exhausted in those areas, and that's why we can't find traces of them today?
No, because they would have found the evidence of the mine workings. I mean, where you have mines, you have mine workings, and they leave a great big mess. I mean, it tears up all the land. They still have problems with it today. If you look at Cornwall, you can see that it's all mine workings, ancient mine workings. So there would have been evidence of them doing that. And there is no evidence of it. I mean, look at this excuse here. They said, oh, it must have come from Iran. Well, they've never found any evidence of any tin in Iran. And also, you know, the geology, you can see from the rocks that are surrounding these areas, the type of rocks that are in an area will tell you what metals are going to be in that area as well. If you've got granite, you know that there's going to be tin in that area. So you can look at a place like Dartmoor, and even if there were no mines on Dartmoor, you could say, well, we know for certain that there is tin in this area because there is all this granite there. But there's no granite in Mesopotamia. So that's how they know there cannot have been any tin there.
Yeah, I was just thinking back to what we were saying about how a lot of the inlands of Europe were relatively uninhabited. And I think the conditions must have been a lot different back then. I mean, if you consider that in Lebanon, around that area, Levant region, the Bible says it always refers to the cedars of Lebanon. And so it must have been quite luscious and green. And so for the climate there to change and become so hot, it might suggest that, you know, Europe must have been a lot cooler and less habitable back then as well.
Well, I think if anything, it was warmer. I know it was warmer in the Middle Ages, wasn't it? But in the Lebanon, where you talk about the cedars of Lebanon, I think we mentioned that a couple of weeks back as well, that the wood from Lebanon was being imported into Mesopotamia. So that area was lush and fertile. Arabia was once called Felix Arabia. So that was fertile as well. That area wasn't all desert like it is now. But I think in the north, I mean, very early at this time, there may have been traces still of the Ice Age. You know, you may be right there that it was colder, but it was certainly covered up with forest. It would have all been forest land. It would have been a great big canopy of trees without the light getting in. And it would have been much easier to build this civilization in the temperate zone rather than in the north. And they were just living on these coastlands. So I think that was the major difference, is that it was all forest back then. Maybe colder in the north as well. And I'd have to look into it, the end of the actual Ice Age and the last of the glaciers. Yeah,
just a thought, that's all. It was worth looking into.
Yeah, we'll look into that before the next episode, find out an exact date for you know, when the Ice Age ended and what the temperature was like. Well, the tin itinerary from Mari, about 100 years after the Kultepi Old Assyrian texts, adds to the list of distribution points but does not say much more about actual sources. Tin was shipped from Mari to such places as Aleppo, Qatna, Ebla. I remember in the first episode we talked about Ebla and the tablets that they discovered there. Laish, which was another name for the city of Dan, mentioned in the Bible. Hazor, and ultimately to the Captorite in Ugarit. The involvement of this person in the tin trade, Captorite, perhaps meaning Cretan, suggests the extent of the distribution of the precious metal. In this period, Larsa and Sippar in southern Mesopotamia played important roles in the tin trade as points from which the tin was then shipped to the north. Beyond southern Mesopotamia, the tin route fades into obscurity, leaving us with the possibilities of Iran and the Persian Gulf as stations from which the tin was shipped. Gudea of Lagash, 22nd century BC, does state specifically that he used tin from the land of Maluha. Unfortunately, the location of Maluha is not precisely known, but it is generally thought to indicate the Indus Valley civilization. And as you go out from Mesopotamia, you've got the Persian Gulf there, and you can go along there, following along basically the coastal route, and that will take you to India and the Indus Valley civilization, which is the next one that I want us to look at, because that's the next civilization that's connected to Mesopotamia. So the tin was coming from Britain, and it was working its way all the way to Mesopotamia, and then theoretically it could have been making its way all the way up to the Indus Valley civilization, because they say here that it may have been tin from Maluha, which they think may have been the Indus Valley civilization, but I'm not sure that they actually know whether there was any tin there or not, whether they've actually located any.
It sounds, I mean, considering how big Britain is, it's a small island. I mean, one thing that's quite astounding is to think that it could potentially, you know, provide all the tin for the known world at that time, and to have some left. Is it just, you know, the amount that we would have would be sufficient, or I don't know. I'm just trying to get my head around how much tin is required to, how much resource and ground I would say needs to be mined in order to provide the tin. You know,
they were still doing it up until last century, lasted all the way up until last century. The only reason they stopped doing it is because they were able to start producing it cheaper elsewhere. There's still plenty of tin there and copper, and you just masses of it. I mean, it incredible wealth that actually came from Cornwall, and the taxes of it were paid to the kings. I mean, Britain was a very, very wealthy country. And again, this is why it was seen as such a magnet to Julius Caesar. That's why he wanted to take Britain, because it was so wealthy. And if you think, you know, these mines show that we had people there that were extracting this ore thousands of years ago, that shows that the people there would have eventually grown, and there would have been a society that formed around that. And of course, that's what we're told with Brutus and the kings there in New Troy. And we had the Druids, and Julius Caesar tells us that the Druids had 40 separate cities in Britain, and they were universities, and all the aristocracy of Gaul, all the nobles, the sons of the nobles in Gaul, they would travel to Britain to be educated by the Druids. And that would have meant that must have been evolving for hundreds of years. So again, this tin trade shows that that would have been possible, because you would have had people here with the knowledge of civilization going back to 2500 BC. So it wouldn't have been very difficult for them to have 40 university cities and be the most highly educated people in Europe by the time of the first century AD. So it confirms how this could have happened, basically, what Julius Caesar tells us.
Yeah, I've heard the Druids were potentially linked to the Levites in the Bible. I don't know if that's got any credence to it.
Oh, there are connections, because the Druids had to show that they had been a free man for 10 generations, and they had to show their genealogy, and the Levites also had to show their genealogy going back 10 generations. I think the clothing they had to wear was the same, which was white wool. The Druids offered up animal sacrifices, and the Levites offered up animal sacrifices. And these sacrifices were propitiation for sin, which is what the Levite priests were doing, and that's also what the Druids were doing. There are a lot of similarities between the Levites and the Druids, and of course, after Christ, before St. Paul, when there was a persecution of the apostles of Christ, the legends tell us that Joseph of Arimathea and Mary came to Britain, and they came to Britain because it was outside of the Roman Empire, so they couldn't be persecuted there. So it makes sense that the Christians that were fleeing from the Roman Empire, they would have come to Britain. It's just logical. And the Druids welcomed them, and that's why Britain was the earliest nation to proclaim itself Christian in 170 AD. It was King Lucius. Wow. That is witnessed by lots of old historians. Even Bede, the Anglo-Saxon historian who tries to run down the Britons, he admits it, that Britain has been Christian since the time of King Lucius. And King Lucius was a descendant of Brutus. But we'll see more of that anyway in this. Go on.
No, I was going to make a point about, sacrifices, and that it's seen as quite barbaric and almost very primitive, and in many ways, a lot of atheists would hold it against, the Old Testament traditions. But when you draw the connections, it's pretty much the same. The same was going off for the ancestors they would accept as Druids. So you kind of weigh things up a little bit, don't you? And I guess suddenly it becomes a bit more understandable.
Well, human sacrifices are barbaric. We're not talking about human sacrifices.
Animal sacrifices. But still, I think the notion of shedding blood, I think to a lot of people, they would, I think they hold it against the Old Testament traditions because, who's that again? Guy Adam Green, he would chastise a lot of the ancient Judaic practices back then, stemming from the Old Testament, and kind of misconstrue it, really, I think.
Well, completely. I don't see how he can try and run that down, because we do the same today. I mean, if you look at the old sacrifices, it was lamb and beef. So, and they would have they had the Festival of Tabernacles, where they would all turn up in tents, and they would stay there in tents for the week, and they would have a huge barbecue. I mean, that's what these sacrifices were. It wasn't all going to waste. They would eat it. You know, it would be roast lamb, the lovely sweet savour of roast lamb and roast beef, and they'd be grilling it all outside, and they'd be eating it. And what do we do today? We go to festivals in tents, and we love grilling. And who is it who loves grilling? It's the white race. Do any of the other races like going out and living in tents? No, they don't, because it reminds them of refugee camps. They wouldn't want to do that for pleasure, for recreation. But we do.
Yeah, I think the sacrifices of the Old Testament were pretty much linked to the Canaanites, right? Where they would put their own babies on Molech, which was a large statue with bronze hands, smeltering bronze hands.
Yeah, the human sacrifices that was a Canaanite that was a Canaanite thing, which is obviously that's completely forbidden. In the Old Testament, the Israelites were forbidden to do that. That's one of the reasons why they were told, you have to get these people out of this land. You know, either have to exterminate them, or you have to push them out of the land. But you cannot have them in the same land that you are living in. Otherwise, they will corrupt you. And that was, these sins that were laid at the feet of the Canaanites, of what they were doing. So they had to remove them. But yeah, they were involved in human sacrifice. And I think later on the Israelites, they didn't get rid of the Canaanites completely in some places, and they did end up copying their practices, and that's why they ended up losing their lands. But we can't say, well, we would never do anything like that, because there's mention of it in Greek myths of human sacrifice. I mean, sadly, this sort of thing did go on. Julius Caesar does allege that the Druids did it, but there's no proof that the Druids did that. no proof whatsoever that the Druids did it. And he is the only witness, I think, in the whole of history that claims that the Druids did that. And that may well have just been black propaganda, him trying to run them down. Because the evidence that we have from people like Taliesin the Bard and the descendants of these Druids who were writing in the 5th and the 6th century, they don't make any mention of anything like that. They say that their beliefs were very, very similar to Christianity. And when Christianity was brought over, it was so similar to the beliefs of the Druids that they just converted to Christianity. They just smoothly made a transition from what they had been following into Christianity. And it was, you know, it wasn't St. Paul's version of Christianity. It was an even earlier version of that than that, which is why there was like a discrepancy between Roman Catholicism and the British Christianity when St. Augustine came over in the 6th century. They had a different date for Easter, and they didn't have baptism. They had slightly different ways of doing things because it was an earlier version of Christianity that came to Britain, and St. Augustine had a later version of it. I'm not saying St. Paul was wrong. I think St. Paul was great. I mean, he was a nationalist. Right the way through, he was a nationalist. But it was just an earlier version that they had, because St. Paul had yet to have his epiphany and all the rest of it. When Joseph of Arimathea and his band of apostles actually came to Britain. But we'll get into that later on, because he's connected into this into the tin trade as well. Recent discoveries from ancient DNA revealed that the Bronze Age in Britain, 2500 to 2800 BC, began with a major population movement from continental Europe and the introduction of the technology of metallurgy, copper and gold, long after it had been adopted elsewhere. So think about that. DNA discoveries tell us that there was a movement into Britain from continental Europe. Where did they come from before continental Europe? Assyria and Phoenicia. That's what I would suggest. Bringing this technology with them, and the technology came from Assyria. And when you look at it on a map, it's you know, it just seems very simple. And how they can't just say, well, this is what happened. I guess it's not politically correct to. Well, a remarkable change occurred circa 2100 BC, when Britain and Ireland were the first region in Europe to completely switch over from copper to the far harder, more easily cast and golden-coloured metal of bronze, which is typically 10% tin and 90% copper for their tools and weapons. This process has recently been termed bronzization and occurred across Europe and Asia. It has been persuasively argued as a form of pre-modern globalization due to the necessary establishment of a complex web of poorly understood long-distance exchange trade routes for the copper and the tin. The first appearance of deliberately alloyed tin bronzes occurred across Southwest Asia by 3000 BC, despite the region mostly lacking significant tin sources. There are subsequently a small number of mostly low tin bronzes found in decreasing density from southeast to southwest and central Europe by around 2200 BC. However, the bronzization of Europe started in the northwest in 2100 BC and occurred subsequently across Europe, with Scandinavia and central Europe becoming fully bronze using by around 1700 BC. And finally, southern Iberia, the Aegean, and Egypt by around 1500 to 1400 BC. So what that is telling us there is that the mines had been in use, but they weren't actually making the things that they needed in Britain until 400 years later, 500 years later. And then in 2100 BC, they started making the bronze in Britain and making the items that they needed. And then it took off from there to the rest of Europe. So if you remember what I was saying earlier about how the Phoenicians prevented anybody else following them to Britain, this confirms this, because this bronzization effect, where everybody learned how to make bronze, spread out from Britain in 2100 BC. But the mines had been in use since 2500 BC. So they'd been mining the stuff in Britain, and then taking it to the Fertile Crescent, to the civilized region, the city states, to make use of it. and just using Cornwall as a place to mine from. And then I guess where people had been there for so long, they built up settlements, and then they started making the implements that they needed there. And then this knowledge of how to make these implements, and probably selling these implements as well and trading them, that happened to the other Europeans that were on the coastline, as it says here, to Scandinavia. It spread from Britain to Scandinavia, and then eventually, finally, southern Iberia, which you would have thought would have been the first, because it's closer to the Fertile Crescent. But because it didn't have tin there, I guess they just bypassed it. They were just, you know, carrying the trade from Britain up to the Levant, to that seaboard there on the Levant.
So are you saying that it was mostly the Phoenicians and in that area? Are you kind of certain that it was the Phoenicians, the sort of more aboriginal Phoenicians?
No, what happened was you had Phoenicia was invaded and taken over by Joshua.
Yeah.
The people that moved in there took on the name of Phoenicians.
But what are the timings accurate? Because I thought the Phoenicians from the, you know, from the Bible, the Israelites, for example, they came into the land of Canaan about 1250 BC. Maybe that's not accurate. I'm not sure the times line up.
I think it was earlier than that, because we worked out that Abraham was at Ur, I think 2025, around about 2500 BC.
Okay.
And they were in Egypt
for about 400 years.
Yeah, so you could take it up to about 2000 BC, probably.
Okay.
But we can look into it, because the Tel El Amarna letters are letters from the Hittites begging the Egyptians to come and help, because Joshua is making war against them. So we can actually date when that was from the Tel El Amarna letters. So again, that's something else that we'll have to look up next week. I did look into these Tel El Amarna letters, but I don't think I've got any quotes that actually describe it.
I mean, it all sounds, kind of plausible. It's just, I think when you get, if you can get the timings right and, then it kind of all just fits together like a jigsaw. But if timings are out, then it kind of just raises a few question marks that we still need to kind of look into.
Well, also don't forget that the Phoenicians, again, it had white people there, and it had these Arab types there, and the Hittites had white people there, and they had these Arab types there. I don't think there's ever been a time when, well, apart from possibly the time when Israel did kick out the Canaanites completely from certain areas, I don't think there's been a time when the Adamites haven't also had these Canaanites or Kenites living alongside them in some percentage. I mean, that's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, perhaps. I just wonder... how we would have averted, kind of intermixing so much, considering the extent that it goes on to today. You know,
well, you had to prove, as I said, you had to be a Levite or to be a Druid. You had to prove your genealogical descent going back 10 generations. So even though you had people that were living in the same area, they would have retained who they were, because they had caste systems and they wouldn't marry out of their caste. And the Hittites were famous for doing that, though. I mean, they would sell their princesses off. But you can see in the Bible, it tells us that the Israelites were told not to do that, and Isaac didn't do that. Esau did do that, and he's castigated for that. And it makes a big point of his mother saying, if Isaac does the same as Esau, my life won't be worth living. And they go and find him a wife from their own kind. And that's the standard that they're supposed to follow. And I think that's that, you know, that there would have been people that knew that they were white would not have interbred, or they would have tried not to. Eventually they did. And you get, you know, whole races of Arab types that were out there. But even at the time of Josephus, when Josephus is writing his histories of Judea, he talks about how Herod and his people were being mocked as being of ignoble birth because they were of mixed race. They were Canaanite, part Canaanite and part Judahite. And some of the Judahites were accusing him of being of ignoble race, or accusing him of being a bastard. And Flavius Josephus, he doesn't really understand this because he says, well, you know, the Herods are pretty clever folk, you know, they're good architects, they might be a bit brutal. He doesn't quite understand the ethnicity side of it, but obviously the people that were saying Herod was of ignoble birth, they obviously understood race. They obviously understood the importance of it. And also the Essenes understood the importance of it because they completely separated themselves from all the multiculturalism that was going on. They said, we're going to have a separate community and we're going to follow these laws. We don't want anything to do with your proselytes of the gate and your proselytes of justice and your multiculturalism. So there were groups that rejected that.
Yeah, I guess one thing we need to consider is the power of and influence that media has on us today in order to shift thinking. So I guess back then it would have been a different time. And they would have, like you say, they had caste systems and different priorities. And we also discussed last week about, you know, passing on seed and, you know, because the world was relatively unpopulated. I think, yeah, you're right in thinking that, you know, your racial lineage was way more important back then, and they understood the you know, what about maintaining a level of purity, how important that was,
especially if you were the, you know, the firstborn son from an important family. You know, then it was very important who you married and who your descendants were, and that they retained their purity. They may have had concubines, but even the concubines would have been of the same race. I mean, you see the importance of it with Abraham marrying his half-sister and the pharaohs marrying their sisters. And, you know, this race thing and this caste thing was very important to some people. People like the Hittites subverted that by marrying off their princesses to the Egyptian pharaohs and to the rest of them. But the offspring of an Egyptian pharaoh with a Hittite princess was very unlikely to then become pharaoh. They wouldn't have been the most important firstborn son, as it were. And each of these heads of the families, the families were like tribes that would go on to become nations. And all the wealth would be kept within a family, and you weren't allowed to sell on your property either. You weren't allowed to sell bits of land or anything like that. That was your land in perpetuity that you would pass on down to your descendants. That's why you had this idea of the Jubilee. Every 40 years, everything would go back to how it was. So there wasn't a possibility of somebody buying everything up and having a monopoly of all the land. So it's a different way of doing things. And I think what we can see from when we looked at Sumer, we could see that even though they were all called Sumerian and they were speaking the Sumerian language, we actually had Adamites there. We had black-headed people there. We had the servant class there, which was like the Arab type. And we had the type that was descended from Cain, the Nephilim type. And yet they were all called Sumerian. And the Adamites ended up interbreeding with the Cainites or the Nephilim, which is why there was a flood. But then after that, you start again, and we identified that Canaan was cursed. So Canaan would not have been able to intermarry with Shem or Japheth. So Canaan must have either married into Ham's family or married into the other peoples that were there. But Shem and Japheth, they would have remained pure. They would have remained just in breeding with their own people. And we know that they were living in these other areas. We know that, for instance, that there were Israelites that were living in Jericho. And that ties in with this Pharez and Zara story as well. That's why in Jericho, the spies go into Jericho, and the woman that lives on the tower there, she waves a red flag out of the window because that's linked to the red cloth that was tied around Zara's wrist, and that was the signal. So just like a little bit of trivia there that ties in, but that shows that there were Israelites that were living in Jericho, so that, and they would have retained this, you know, we can only marry our own people, even though we're living in a different era. Same as today, where you have a multicultural center, and people from one group will marry within their own group. They won't necessarily intermarry. The only reason why people intermarry with other groups now is because of all this crazy propaganda that we get. And another interesting bit also, just to tie in here, today, much of the media, which we often talk about, much of the media is in the hands of the Jewish people. Well, back then, we can trace them back, and the Jewish people at one stage were known as the Kenites. And it tells us that the Kenites were the scribes. So they were writing down what they were told to write down. So even back then, they were doing the same thing. So you're saying, you know, the importance of the media and what effect the media had on them. Well, they had the same problems back then, I dare say. They had to be very careful about what these Kenites were putting on these tablets to make certain that they were just putting down what they were supposed to put on these tablets. Because the Bible tells us at one point that these Kenites had distorted the law. They had distorted what they were supposed to write down. So they had the same problem back then. That's what I mean by we've been living together all these years.
Yeah.
And that's what I find fascinating. We look at today and we think, well, we're in a completely different situation today that nobody's ever faced before. We have. We've faced it again and again and again throughout our history. And lots of our empires have fallen to miscegenation. Like the whole of the Near East fell to miscegenation. And currently, Europe is facing the same problem. But what we're living through today, they were living through in the Near East 3,000 years ago. There's a prayer from an Egyptian guy, an Egyptian priest, and he's praying, and it's called the Prayer of Ipuwer. And he's saying that the land is filled with foreigners, and the foreigners are treated better than the Egyptians, and all our taxes are going to pay on the foreigners, and the Egyptians are starving. And, you know, it's like a sort of nationalist's prayer today. And this is like 3,000 or 4,000 years old. This white Egyptian guy who's complaining about multiculturalism in Egypt. It's called the Prayer of Ipuwer.
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, I will look it up. And maybe we can, we'll probably include it at some point in this series. Maybe when we get to...
We're going to touch on Egypt, aren't we, at some point?
Yeah, we're going to look at Egypt. We will get to Egypt. And I want to do the Silk Route as well. There's some fascinating information when we start looking at China. But we'll stay on this this tin trade for now. I'm just wondering whether we should get into this next bit before we finish as well. The fact the tin trade existed is too well attested to need proof. Herodotus, as early as 445 BC, speaks of the British Isles as the Tin Islands or the Cassiterides. Pytheas, in 352 to 323 BC, mentions the tin trade, as does Polybius, circa 160. Diodorus Siculus gives a detailed description of the trade. He tells us that the tin was mined, beaten into squares, and carried to an island called Ictus, joined to the mainland at low tide, which is generally thought to be Mount St. Michael in Cornwall, although some have identified it with Falmouth. After that, it was shipped to Morlaix and transported across France on pack horses to Marseille. From Marseille, it was again shipped to Phoenicia. Innumerable ancient workings in Cornwall still attest to the trade, and tin is still mined there today. Lord Avebury and Sir John Evans hold the opinion that the trade existed as early as 1500 BC. Well, we're suggesting it goes back earlier than that. In actual fact, the mainstream admit that it goes back earlier than that now. And Sir Edward Creasy writes, the British mines mainly supplied the glorious adornment of Solomon's Temple. This matter ties in very well with the involvement of Phoenician builders with the construction of Solomon's Temple. Because, of course, when you read about Solomon's Temple in the Old Testament, it tells you that they came from Sidon and Tyre and from Phoenicia in order to help build the temple. And the people that were living in Phoenicia at the time, again, they were Israelites. They were getting this. They were getting their tin and they were getting their copper from Britain. So that's how important Britain was to the to the ancient world. We've got loads more that we'll get into in this next week, but I think we should leave that here for now. So thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. It's been insightful. Learned a lot of this one.
Yeah, I've enjoyed this. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.